Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton reporting for duty.
And now for this week's conundrum. No conundrum. Star Trek Beyond, yo.
Yeah, Cam, you and I, we just saw it last night at the Thursday night premiere. We got free posters.
Last night, you say?
Yes.
The last night of when we recorded this.
Exactly.
Yes.
For any listener, yes, yes. Last night.
Yeah.
No, but we saw it at the premiere.
Mm-hmm.
So we should mention that. We had...
I sat next to Simon Pegg.
Yeah. I walked down the red carpet with Zoe Saldana.
Oh, right.
It was quite amazing. Anyway, moving on. Cam, let's just get started. I mean, what were your expectations prior to this film?
My expectations were not lofty. My expectations were that it would be approaching the level of fun of the 2009 JJ movie.
I really hope that's what it says in the movie posters. Expectations, not lofty.
Keep them low, people.
Yeah.
So that was really what I was expecting. I didn't think it would meet the 2009 one, but I was hoping for something along those lines as opposed to an Into Darkness.
I think, you know, over the last year and a half, we've been going back and forth, and I've been wavering so much about how I felt about this movie. I think, you know, when Bob Orsi was still attached to it, and he was getting shoved out, and we had a lot of question marks about Bob Orsi as well.
I dreaded the movie at that point.
I did as well, and we found out later it had to do with Vulcans and time travel, or
yeah, it was
some sort of MacGuffin.
It was like three groups in like a chase for something, sort of time travel device or something.
I like chase movies.
Sure.
Yeah, well, so, and then they get rid of him, they bring on Simon Pegg and Justin Lin, and I'm like, okay, well, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just no buzz whatsoever, and to me that, you know, created a lot of warning signs. I wasn't a big fan of the first trailer.
Yeah.
So, my feelings vacillated about this so much, and then, like, the reviews started coming out, and they were through the roof, and
yeah.
So I didn't want to get, you know, my expectations up too high.
Right.
But I went in there, like, hoping for a good, dumb, fun space adventure.
Right. So, kind of a lot like me, along the lines of the J.J. Abrams first one.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I honestly didn't think it was going to be as good as that first one. That's a great film.
Yeah, it's like, it takes a script that's pretty shaky, but it has so much energy in life.
Yeah.
That it's just like a perfect example of a director just completely working with kind of lower, you know, not great material, but just hitting out of the park.
Well, Cam, just for any new listeners who may not have heard the show before, you and I, we're not J.J. Abrams-verse haters, or I should say Kelvin timeline haters or anything like
that. Not at all.
You know, you and I weren't huge fans of Into Darkness, but we're not among the contingent of hardcore Star Trek fans that refuse to acknowledge that the Kelvin timeline exists or anything like that.
Yeah, not at all. And in fact, on this episode in the archives, if you go to subspacepod.com, I'll put links to all our previous movie episodes.
Yeah, maybe, you know what? We've ranked the films before. Maybe at the end of this one, we can readjust our rankings a little bit and tell listeners how it is. But Cam, your experience watching it, when you came out of the theater, how did you feel?
I really enjoyed the movie. I've kind of made peace with the fact that these new Paramount Kelvin timeline movies, by virtue of the fact they cost like $180 million, are going to be four quadrant movies that are essentially action blockbusters.
And for listeners who may not know, what is four quadrant mean?
It means it appeals to everyone.
Right. It's a movie for everyone, and that always makes me fearful that it's a movie for no one.
Right. Whereas, like, you know, when they were doing like next gen movies, they were pretty cheap. A lot of them were on the cheaper. So
like
you could
$45 million tops for a budget.
Yeah.
Actually, no, sorry. Nemesis actually had, I think, like $60 million. And
still pretty low.
Yeah.
So you could make a weirder kind of TNG movie and still break even and make a profit. So that's just not the case with these, though. So I kind of just accepted the fact that they were going to be, I think I even compared them at a certain point to kind of like the Bond franchise, where they're just kind of follow the trends of kind of what's going on.
Yeah.
Try and infuse it with enough of the franchise flavor, but kind of just, you know, be blockbusters. And this one, I think, is. This one actually reminded me a lot of, speaking of Bond, Skyfall. Whereas, like, this was not Casino Royale. This was not the shot in the arm the 2009 film was, where we walked out like kind of like, oh my god, yeah. I can't wait for the sequel already.
There's no scenes of Kirk getting hit in the balls with a big piece of rope, right?
Unfortunately. Yeah. No.
That's a Casino Royale reference, people. Look it up.
Right. Whereas, you know, when you get to Quantum of Solace, that one really drops the ball. Like, all the goodwill built up from Casino Royale was kind of gone.
It drops the ball like Bond falling out of the sky without a parachute.
That's right.
There you go. Hey, that's a Quantum of Solace reference, people. Look it up. Yeah,
and that's how Into Darkness left me feeling when I walked out. I remember, like, at the time, referring as when I came out, like, as a generic space adventure movie.
See, I was higher on Into Darkness after initially walking out of the theater.
Yeah.
I remember we were discussing that with a couple friends that we went and saw it with previous guests on the show, one Adrian McNair and one Benjamin Yong.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's repeat viewings of Into Darkness. Look, that first viewing of it, I couldn't get over that dumb Tribble Blood. You know, that really bugged me. But repeat viewings, my feelings of Into Darkness definitely deteriorated from that high that I initially felt walking out of there.
Yeah.
So you walk out of Beyond, you're loving it.
Skyfall is a movie that has so many of the classic Bond tropes. You know, it really does have so many that, as a fan of Bond, it pleased me to no end. But I have issues with it, and that is how I feel about this one. This is not recapturing, at least, how the magic I felt for the 2009 film. And I know a lot of fans aren't big fans of that one because it doesn't have the hard sci-fi premises and so forth. Honestly, I've kind of given up on that.
Yeah.
But this one delivers enough of what I wanted that I walked out genuinely happy.
Okay, interesting. I'll give you my thoughts. And I'm going to have to blame one of our friends here.
Uh-oh.
So, Cam, of course, our fallen comrade, Benjamin Yong, he shows up incredibly late for the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. And he got locked in his carport.
It's not a joke. He got locked in his garage. Power went out, so he had to take... he had to walk to the rapid transit station and trek all the way downtown to where we were seeing the film.
Trek, you say?
Oh, that was an unintentional...
Sure it was.
Sorry, it truly was. And so anyways, he gives me a phone call, and then even though you are holding the tickets, Cam, it's up to me to go deliver the ticket to him once he's ready to arrive in the theater.
But he was calling you.
I know.
I had my phone turned off at that point.
What? No, it was like 40 minutes before the movie started. You had your phone turned off?
It was not 40 minutes.
No, when he initially called me on the phone.
Oh, I didn't... Yeah.
I'm sure our listeners are fascinated by this.
I turned my phone off about 2 minutes before, three minutes before.
Anyways... suddenly, I'm saddled with the duty of running downstairs and delivering him his ticket. So, Cam, you'd say I missed about the first 3 minutes of the
movie. Yes, I would say you missed the opening scene, which is a scene where Kirk is trying to broker peace with this race of very, very poorly rendered CG aliens. And he's offering them this weapon from another race that is a piece of a great weapon. And that is the MacGuffin of the entire movie.
Okay.
So that is essentially, they attack him and they turn out to be really tiny, waka waka waka. Spoilers for Star Trek Beyond, we should say. This entire episode is going to be spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie, go see it first.
And I guess you've spoiled the first 3 minutes, Cam.
That's right, I've spoiled the first three.
So all I can say, though, is I walk into the theater 3 minutes in, and it's Kirk doing that monologue where he's just talking about how he's out in space, what's going on, here's a recap, and it's mopey Kirk not wanting to be a captain anymore because, I don't know, he's exploring the galaxy too much. He doesn't know what the goal is.
Right.
And I don't know, for whatever reason, the tone of it just really irked me.
Really?
And I couldn't get over it throughout the entire film. It's just the tone of it. And guys, believe me, nobody wanted to like this film more than I did.
Mm-hmm.
My expectations were high. I like the J.J. Abrams universe, you know. But there's just something about the tone throughout the film that seemed off, and I feel like one of those like nonsensical Trek fans that I see on Facebook all the time that just keep whining about how this isn't the Star Trek universe they know, but it didn't feel, throughout the entire film, it didn't feel like Star Trek to me. And so what I had to do, and it was at a certain point where we were on the Franklin, which I like, and don't get me wrong, there are a lot of things I like about this film.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, I was just like, okay, well, can I just sit back and enjoy it as, like, a fun, dumb space adventure, which is all I really wanted.
Right.
And to varying degrees, I could. This is absolutely a movie that I need to see again because I didn't come out of it disliking it, and I didn't come out of it, you know, jubilant either. So it's a movie that I had just such weird feelings at the time watching it. I need to step back. And Cam, I think you and I will probably end up catching it in the next week or two once again, right?
I think we're marked to see it in Vegas, too.
Yeah, well, that's what I was referring to. Oh, okay, yeah,
for sure.
Of course, new listeners, Cameron and I, we will be in Las Vegas at the world's largest Star Trek convention. We will be on stage.
After hours.
After hours, yeah. When there's no one guarding the stage.
Yeah.
No, we'll be moderating a panel, or not moderating, we'll be putting on a panel in which we talk about the influence that film has had on the Star Trek universe.
Right.
Anyways, that was a short plug. But so this is a movie that I need to see again because I just feel so mixed about it. But it's not a movie that I hate. It's one that leaves me just kind of scratching my head.
Right.
So, I don't know. Why don't we dive into it? You know, we typically do a format for our movie reviews. And I don't know, Cam, is there something that you wanted to bring up first, though?
No.
Okay, so we'll talk about first what works and maybe what doesn't work. But Cam, tell me, what works for you here?
I was going to say the entire opening of the movie.
Which?
Not the first 3 minutes. I shouldn't say that I was like...
Well, bring up...
I was genuinely concerned with the first three minutes.
You told me after we left the theater, what?
Yeah, that, I mean, well... Considering how spectacularly the two J.J. Abrams movies opened, I was concerned. I was like, oh no. Like,
there's no volcano here.
You do not open with like aliens that look that bad. Like, it looked like the Scorpion King is what I referred to. Like, it was really lousy CG. And I was like, oh no. Oh no. Like, what is this going to be? But once that was out of the way, I actually really loved... I'm going to say especially love the first 45 minutes of this movie.
Okay.
I really think this is the closest any Star Trek movie has ever come to capturing the 60s TV series.
Okay, I'm going to disagree with you there.
Really?
Because I genuinely think, and I know a lot of new listeners, you're going to be like, oh, we're shutting the podcast off now. But I swear, go back and listen to our Star Trek V, The Final Frontier podcast, and I think I justify it, but... I really think that The Final Frontier comes the closest to, like, recapturing the spirit of the original TV series. Cam?
I would say it does in terms of plotting, but in terms of feel, in terms of
like
tone.
Like spirit?
In terms of the storytelling of that one, yeah, sure.
Okay.
I agree. It's mostly a remake of Way to Eden in a lot of ways. But in terms of, like, the colors, the atmosphere, just the tone, the way Chris Pine plays Kirk, this to me felt... like, really, like the 60s TV series.
See, okay, that's the thing. I'm going back to tone here, and the entire time I watched it, I was like, this doesn't really feel like the 60s TV series so much. Yeah, and I was especially thinking, like, Pine. I was like, this is, like, mopey Kirk.
Like, I didn't think he was mopey.
No, that...
He was just down. He was confused about his place in the universe, which we'll get to later with another character that ties into.
Okay. I don't know. It's just very interesting that we just come away with it. And believe me, I think based on what I've been seeing on Facebook so far, I have no illusions. I think I'm in the minority on this. And I don't want to be. I want to love this movie. And there's so much about it that I like.
Right.
I just have this weird like feeling. Cam, you and I, we went and saw The Dark Knight Rises. In 2012.
Yeah.
That's still a movie I haven't quite wrapped my head around. Like, it's a film that I like. But Cam, you and I, we left that, and like I kept saying how the tone of that just seems so ominous and like doomsday-ish, you know?
Were you confused who fixed the autopilot?
with the nuclear vessel, or nuclear bomb, I should say.
Yeah,
but yeah, that was bizarre. I don't know, but like again, that was a film where like the tone threw me off all throughout. The only other movie... that was like that, Star Trek Beyond, where just throughout the film, I think the tone really kind of threw me off.
Right.
I can't explain it. You know, I'll try to justify myself
before
I really, you know, alienate all our listeners here. But...
Okay, well, I'll move on a bit.
Okay.
Because we'll save some of that for what doesn't work.
Yes.
But,
yeah, we're still on what works.
Yeah. I wanted to say, though, just we can come back to this later, but I absolutely loved... the opening monologue or voiceover from Kirk.
See, that's what threw me off at the beginning of the movie. Like, that's... I was
in love with the movie at that moment.
See, okay, for me, it was like during the trailer when he was doing that in the trailer, I was just like, I can get behind it. This is a guy who's got, you know, hang-ups and, you know, like, I like that they're giving some depth to it. And then when I just see... I don't know, I just... Look, I have no issues with a captain feeling internal conflict. Right. I totally dig that. I think that's a great thing when Star Trek does it. I don't think Star Trek does it often enough. Mm-hmm. So I was looking forward to it, and it didn't feel like Kirk would want to give up command of the Enterprise because they're exploring too much.
Well, it was after season 3, theoretically.
No, because, okay, no.
It's a new timeline, I know.
But if you look at the dates, though, when they showed Prime Universe Spock's death, it's actually still before the start of the series.
Although they're still referencing things within the series.
I still can't wrap my head fully around this timeline, especially when it comes to the ranks and who had, like, Lieutenant Sulu, you know, is still Lieutenant Sulu, even though this takes place 10 years before...
Yeah,
I don't know.
He's not down in botany or whatever.
Chekhov's
on the ship.
I'm not going to get too hung up on that sort of stuff. Maybe for a second here, can I get into stuff that I liked?
Sure.
I don't want to crap on this movie because like there's a lot that I liked in it, but would I describe it as a movie that I'm jubilant about? No.
Right. I'm not like over the moon. I think there's actually a better blockbuster from this summer, which I'm going to reference later, but continue.
Okay. Alice Through the Looking Glass.
Damn it.
So stuff that worked, when we go to character moments, and I'm going to just start with the best thing that worked for me, and I don't know, well, no, I think it's obvious why. When Spock opens up those belongings from Prime Spock, and he pulls out that photo from Star Trek V, The Final Frontier,
okay.
I can tell it's from that era because of Nichelle Nichols' hair.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
At least she wasn't wearing the fans.
That would have been amazing.
That would have been.
You're like, whoa.
I would have given it 5 stars just for that.
Well, it makes more sense why the Kelvin Spock and the Kelvin Uhura are still together. You know, right. He's holding on to those photos. Yeah. He's like, hey, no, I need to stick with Uhura now if I know this is what I'm getting in a couple of decades. You know. But I love that moment. It was such a character moment. It hit me right in the gut. And I was just like, oh, I love this. You know, that's a small moment. But on a broader level, what works for me, I think like the introduction of the Franklin, I dug the Franklin, so that worked for me. You know, that looked cool, and I kind of liked Jayla, you know? I wish her voice wasn't so silly.
I think that's her real accent.
Okay. Well, okay, no, but more like her English language skills.
Right, yeah.
You know.
I thought, like, Sophia Boutella, Boutella. I think her character, Jayla, worked really well for this movie. If, however, she was being set up to, like, join the crew in a future movie, then I would say it wasn't done that well.
Well,
that's my opinion. As a one-and-done character, I think she was fine and, you know, did really well.
Sure.
But if this is, like, the setup of the next Carol Marcus...
I think it is.
Then I'm a little concerned.
Could you have used some Carol Marcus in this film?
Eh.
Okay.
You know what? I feel like... And this is a really kind of a slam against maybe this franchise as a whole. The JJ ones, at least. Is that, like, I really, really like Zoe Saldana's Uhura.
Yeah.
A lot. Like, I want her to be a main character.
Yeah.
And I feel like every time they bring in another female character, they take scenes away from her.
Well, you look at Into Darkness, though.
Yeah.
And I think she was far more featured in that, even though we do have Carol Marcus in there. You know, like, But I kind of dug Jayla in this as well. Okay, here's kind of what I did like about the film. I feel bad that I'm just picking up little moments as opposed to speaking in broader terms, but I like the idea of just pairing people off like they did.
That's on my list. I think that is one of the most genius things this movie does, is pair off the characters in interesting ways.
I thought the Kirk-Chekhov pair off was, that was genius to me, and I think they work so well together, the chemistry. I think it's very obvious why you pair up Spock and McCoy. Yeah. That works well.
Carl Urban. I mean, Carl Urban has been like this secret weapon who has never been utilized before in these movies. He's always kind of had, you know, like little fun moments, but never allowed to do that much. This time, it's finally like, let's finally make use of this guy.
Yeah.
And you know what? They did that for everyone. Sulu had lots to do. Chekhov had lots to do. Through all these pairings, you know, it's kind of the Avengers pairing. Joss Whedon was really good at that, was pairing off each of the Avengers in interesting ways at different points throughout the film.
So who's the Hawkeye and the Black Widow here?
Oh boy. Well, I mean, I think you gotta give Zoe Saldana the Black Widow.
So does that make Spock Hawkeye?
No, I think he'd be, Spock would be Hulk.
Oh, okay, right? Got you there.
Yeah.
Okay. So then, who's her best bud?
Oh boy. Uh, Sulu in this movie.
Okay, so there.
Yeah, sure.
John Cho, you're the next Hawkeye.
Awesome.
Okay. Go on.
No, but
I apologize for that tangent.
I thought the pairings really helped explore the personalities of all of the characters in a way that the J.J. Abrams movies didn't really have time to.
Yeah. I think another great pairing here is the Jayla Scotty pairing. Like, yeah. And I was kind of surprised because, you know, you're kind of leaving Scotty on his own.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't done that much except hang out with Keenster a lot in these films. And
who had more to do this time.
Yeah, Sneeze.
Yeah.
Which I thought was nice.
Yeah, it was cool.
And I thought he worked really well. Hey, Simon Pegg, who wrote the film, co-wrote the film, you know, yeah. He was smart on his part. The pairing that I think was the weakest was the Uhura-Sulu pairing.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have a lot to do because they're trapped by the villain. And we know they aren't really going to get loose. So it's more about just finding ways of discovering exposition.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was just fun to see the two of them doing stuff together, because that's not a pair that's, like, ever been explored at all.
No.
Like, so, ever?
And after this, I don't think it'll be explored that much again.
Maybe not. Okay. But I really just appreciated seeing it. You know, John Cho, again, kind of ignored, especially in the last one.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about what works here. Like, I think the Sulu stuff, like, is he not the most, like, just normal kind of human character, relatable person in this? Just, like, they're giving him a family. Yeah. They show that he's not just Starfleet through and through. Like, he has a life outside of this. You know? I dug it. And, like, look, we talked about it a couple weeks ago with, like, the whole, like, gay, like, revelation here. How do you think it was handled in the film?
Just fine.
I think it was, like, done as exactly how you should approach it in Star Trek, you know? Right. And I think it's great. We see that he has a family. I don't think it changes anything about how you want to perceive Sulu in the Prime timeline. It's whatever. Yeah. And, I don't know. I thought it worked well. And and the other thing is, do you see anybody on social media, like, bitching about this?
No.
Not at all. And I was very worried we get a lot of, like, ignorant fans, like, just, like, clamoring around to, like, I don't know, raise pitchforks or whatever.
It's so innocuous that it's hard to get upset about.
Yeah, who? Okay, if you're getting upset about this, you got problems, bro.
Yeah.
Or sis. Yeah. Anyway, I think the Sulu stuff works. The other thing that I want to highlight here, and then we'll get over to you, Cam. Mm. I've been talking a lot.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
You're used to it, aren't you? I dug just the variety of aliens that we got to see throughout this, especially that woman... who has, like, a skull that opens up.
Like, it's like a face hugger.
Yeah. I thought that was kind of cool.
I did, too. I did appreciate the variety of aliens, although when I was walking to the SkyTrain station with Ben Yong after the movie, we were talking about how it was kind of a bummer that they haven't worked in more, like, original series aliens just into crowds. Like, we haven't seen maybe a Tellarite in a crowd or an Andorian. You know, we've seen the Orions show up occasionally, but that's really about it. The odd Vulcan.
Well, we saw that one Orion ship member push a man out of her room.
Yes, we did.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go back to one more thing that I thought worked, and then I'll let you speak. I swear.
Yeah.
You're bringing up, you know, like, references to old school aliens, which makes me think of Enterprise, where we've got a lot of Tellarites there. We've got a lot of Andorians there.
Yeah.
I loved, for whatever reason, like, whoever watched this seems to be a big fan of Enterprise, though.
When they referenced the Zindi War, I was happier than I may have ever been in my life.
Or what about, like, the Makos? They were referencing the Makos.
Yes.
And, like, even, like, the design of the Franklin.
Yeah.
It's, like, obviously maybe, I think if you judge it by the timeline, it would have taken place about 5 to 10 years after Enterprise left space dock for its initial mission.
Right.
So that you can definitely see why it was based on that design. I loved kind of how it was referencing canon of Star Trek without being beaten you over the head with it. Like, Zindi War, Romulan War.
Yeah, and there it's, you know, I'm at a point in time prior to seeing this movie where I'm like, the only shows I expect them to hear referenced really are TNG and original series.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, it's just like, that's the way the movie franchises have worked traditionally. It's like, they ain't gonna reference Voyager or whatever. And the fact that they were referencing Enterprise was like, oh my god, like, this is incredible.
And when they do reference Deep Space Nine, it's like Section 31.
It was something,
but I didn't really like... The thing is, I don't think they actually understood Section 31 in Into Darkness.
Because I don't think Roberto Orsi understands Star Trek very well.
No, you can tell he's a fan, but yeah. I think he's one of those fans that you see posting a lot on social media that like they like Deep Space Nine because a lot of ships blow up, and, yeah. which to me isn't the point of right. it. But it, just for the record, again, Section 31 is not a Starfleet operation. It's not Starfleet Black Ops. It's a Federation organization that includes Starfleet operatives. I'm geeking out. This is a Star Trek podcast. Thank you very much. I think I've earned that right.
Maybe in the Kelvin timeline, that's changed.
Oh, God. Don't get me started, Cameron. Okay, Cam, I apologize because yeah. I was crapping on the movie. I needed to go talk about what I did like about it. Because, believe me, guys, I liked a lot about this. Mm-hmm. But, Cam, you tell me.
Let's talk a little bit about Justin Lin. Because Justin Lin, as a director, he did the Fast and Furious movies. And I'm not going to say the Fast and Furious 5 and 6, which are the two best ones he did,
yep.
are near my favorite movies in any way, shape, or form.
But
I think they're great-looking, disposable blockbusters that have a lot of high-energy action sequences. And I don't think he ever quite tops the action in, say, like in like the safe chase in Fast 5.
Oh, yeah.
In this movie, but I thought, you know, we should pay credit to the, like some of his best moments, which I thought the destruction of the Enterprise
was amazing.
And I loved that it was kind of prolonged and it felt like it was building in stages. I've seen some complain that it was too long. I really felt like you could kind of feel it get worse and worse, almost like a disaster movie, like Towering Inferno or something.
Well, okay, it starts with the nacelles getting pulled off and then it culminates with, okay, let's destroy the neck. That's not something we've ever seen in Trek before, but when you look at the basic design of the Enterprise, you're like, oh yeah, that is ripe for it to get its neck ripped right off. And to finally see it realized on screen. Yeah, Cam, you're totally right. Like, that was a great sequence there. And talking about Justin Lin, though, just for, you know, listeners, we've said in the past, like, we like him as a director. If you watch those Fast and Furious movies, I think a lot of people think that they're just stupid movies. Cam, you've described it as like dumb Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, like those movies set out to do something, they accomplished that. And I think Justin Lin has been very, very good managing, you know, these ensemble casts as well as managing these good, these kind of cool set pieces when it comes to action. He's a good director.
And I thought the final action set piece with Kirk and Krall was actually fairly effective too, and I see from the look on your face that you are not a fan.
I'll save my thoughts for that.
Okay, we'll save that. Okay. But you know, also, I don't think Justin Lin is like a visually dynamic director. I think J.J. Abrams is more so,
sure,
by considerable margin. I think like you could actually almost smuggle this in as a J.J. Abrams movie, and people wouldn't maybe have noticed, other than the lens flares not being as prominent. But I loved that Justin Lin found new ways to shoot the Enterprise, and a lot of them were really dynamic and interesting.
The only thing I'll take issue with, and you kind of dismissed me when I brought this up.
Yeah.
Okay, because I agree. That shot of the Enterprise where it looks like the camera is fixed to it and you're seeing it from, like, leaving the Yorktown space station. I just thought that the nacelles were, like, way too close together. Like, it didn't seem, it just seemed like as if it was a skewed view or something like that. And you said, no, the nacelles look fine to me. But right. I still couldn't get over it. Like, it looked as if the nacelles were about to touch each other at a certain point. They should, to me, I've always envisioned them as much further apart from one another. Well, so there you go, Justin Lin.
You've never been that close to the Enterprise, though. Maybe they do look like that from that point of view.
That's very true. I'm sorry. But I have model Enterprises.
But I just loved how, you know, he...
Sorry, Cam, did you buy one of those toppers for your pop at the movies?
I did not.
They're an extra $2.99 in Canada.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was debating it. I bought a bottle of water. I was wondering if they would maybe sell me like one of the toppers that included like an Enterprise.
I'm sure they would.
Yeah, okay.
But no, I loved it, like, you know, he found new ways to shoot the Enterprise. Because we've seen in some of the past movies, they would kind of repeat, you know, we weren't getting a lot of visually dynamic looks at the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And this one, he always thought of something, whether it's the camera kind of spinning around the Enterprise, whether it's that, you know, the shot of it going through, like, the warp field. It always felt like I was seeing a new shot of the Enterprise, not an insert shot from maybe a different movie.
Well, that's the thing that surprises me, is because you can think of, like, every single ship that they featured in the Star Trek series, they look pretty beautiful.
Yeah.
And you also kind of wonder why, how do they not, like, feature them in new and unique ways? A lot of it is budgetary issues, but Cam, I am going through my TNG Blu-rays right now, and it's like, oh yes, that it's one of exactly four shots of the Enterprise like swiping by you, and it's just kind of like, okay, there's so many more beautiful ways to look at it. Okay, one of the reasons I really like Generations, though, is because I've never thought that Enterprise D looked more beautiful than how it was featured in Generations, and we're seeing brand new shots of it, and right. I thought that really worked for me.
And for the first time on the big screen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even though I think, Cam, you and I, we both rated Generations as the worst Star Trek movie.
I did, yeah. For sure.
Ugh, okay.
Yeah. But, you know, I think Lin deserves a lot of credit for that, and we know he can shoot cars fantastically.
Yes.
He proved that over and over furiously. And over again. And furiously. But I loved also his work showing off the Yorktown, the space station in space. Like, there is that opening shot where it's like the camera's swooping and turning, all this, all throughout the Yorktown.
Yeah.
I thought it was impressive. It had grandeur. I mean, he was basically doing the section from Tomorrowland, but way better. Like, that's the way it should have been done in that piece of shit movie. I mean, the
Both
Yorktown...
Both films made in Vancouver.
That's right. Yeah. The Yorktown, I thought, looked beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, that is what I kind of imagined. Like, if they were to reboot DS9, I feel like that's what, you know, DS9 would kind of look like when you got really close. Would be kind of the busyness of it like that.
Well, I think... Look, if you look at space dock from, what was it, Star Trek 3 that it first made its appearance?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a more beautiful looking space station featured in Star Trek?
No, maybe not.
Like, it's quite fantastic to look at, and just the scale of it. And I think this is the closest they've ever come to topping.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, I'm somebody who loves the design of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
DS9, Terraknor, it's supposed to be ugly looking.
Yeah.
You know? But this was just so innovative, you know, and I love how they kind of have almost a... not quite terraformed, but like this atmospheric kind of space station,
mm-hmm.
And gravity streams, right. You know, as well. But yeah, it looked innovative. And that's what I'm always looking for when it comes to Star Trek, is just this kind of innovation, this sense of wonder.
Right.
So yeah, the Yorktown, that worked for me.
Yeah, so just on a visual level, like I thought this movie, I don't know if it surpasses the JJ movies. I don't think so. But I think it had moments that stood up, at least with the best of the JJ movies.
Okay. Just your own thoughts. Maybe you haven't thought about it, but I've been trying to wrap my head around it.
Okay.
What do you think the population is of the Yorktown?
I don't know. What have you been thinking?
To me, it seems almost impossible to judge. Like, it looks giant.
Yeah.
I believe they did, like, second unit shooting in Seoul, South Korea, to give it the look, as well as Abu Dhabi.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Like, if I had to wager a guess, I think it's way bigger than what you could possibly justify for some space station at, like, the edge of the Federation,
right.
Like, territory. If you look at it, I'm guessing maybe, like, 30 million people?
Wow.
Which seems enormous, but, like, I'm just basing it, like, on all those, like, skyscrapers. And the scale of it, just based on, like, the size of the Enterprise, it looks massive. That's why I think, like, it's very possible 30 million plus people out at the very edge of Federation space for what reason? Near a nebula that is very dangerous?
Yeah.
We can get into that a little bit later on.
Yes. But, you know, getting back to Lin, I thought Lin, one of the other great things about this movie is his, I thought, measuring of tone. I know you were iffy on the tone, but I feel like one of the huge issues was the 2009 movie was so consistent. It just,
yes.
Like, flew by. And then Into Darkness was, like, so bumpy. It just, like, felt kind of all over the place. You had bad comedy to, you know, cut to, like, this brooding moodiness. And then cut to, like, you know, homages to Wrath of Khan. Like, it felt like just, like, a patchwork.
Yeah.
And I felt like Justin Lin knew kind of the movie he wanted to tell. And it was a very fast 2 hours, at least I felt. Like,
yeah,
this
no,
to me
I
felt
agree.
Like a consistent... You know, I've seen some fans can refer to it, the fans who are really positive on it, refer to it as like a successful insurrection, where it felt like, it felt stripped from the TV show, but in a way that felt like fit for the big screen, as
okay.
opposed to just kind of two episodes, you know, kind of taped together.
I can see where they're coming from. I would have appreciated more bales of hay.
Of course.
In this version.
Right.
You know. I think what we're ultimately getting at, though, is that you and I, we both really like Justin Lin as director. And I know
yeah.
a lot of people dismiss him as, like, Fast and the Furious, as if that's something to be proud of. That's your sister, by the way. Yeah. Go listen to our previous episode when we reviewed the trailer. Cam's sister and my sister both call in to the podcast, guys.
That's right.
Well, let's tackle the script. What did you think of the script from Simon Pegg and Doug Jung? Because here's the thing, I like Simon Pegg a lot as as a script writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think Simon Pegg's genius was really, I mean, Simon Pegg knows these characters.
Yeah.
And obviously Doug Jung does too. but I thought the two of them both really nailed every character in the whole crew. And I think they had good ideas. I think there's sections we're going to get into that didn't work. But I think in terms of like making a character-based blockbuster,
yeah,
this works, I think, as well as you could hope.
Well, you all already mentioned this, but the whole idea of just pairing people off is genius. And it was actually something that I had never really thought of until I was watching Battlestar Galactica, and there's an episode in which they end up on Kim, you haven't watched it.
Not yet, but
spoiler alert, they end up on one particular planet, and Ron Moore, former Star Trek writer for TNG, Deep Space Nine, and very briefly Voyager, he mentions in his podcast that the trick to like good writing when you have like a big group of people on like one particular location, just put them in pairs.
Right.
And it's so much easier to write and give people things to do.
Right.
Simon Pegg, I don't know if you listened to that particular podcast from Ron Moore, but it works here. And I think that was absolutely genius on his part, as well as Doug Jung's, to like get them all in pairs. That means you have people consistently have like kind of a goal.
Yeah.
And then you're giving them character moments within that. And that totally makes sense from like a narrative standpoint, and it's just good screenwriting.
And then bringing in new characters like Jayla or Krall, like they feel organic to the story. They don't feel kind of awkward like Carol Marcus, you know, where it's kind of like you could tell that why they wanted her there, but even the movie's acknowledging like, what do you do? Why do we need you?
The worst part about Carol Marcus is that they needed to make her Alexander Marcus's daughter.
Yeah.
And that to me kind of diminished her role and like her importance. And I was just like, guys, come on.
Yeah.
Be smart about this.
I mean, even the way they wedged Khan in felt awkward at times, I felt.
Well, let me ask you this, though. And I'm not being crass, I don't think, because we know that Carol Marcus and Kirk have relations in the prime timeline. And we get one David Marcus out of this. Do you think that at this point, like, Kirk and Carol Marcus, David's around? I don't know.
I have no reason to think that.
I have no reason to think that either, because there's no relation struck up in Darkness.
There was no sexual chemistry on that in that movie.
Other than Kirk the Peeping Tom.
Yeah. No, I don't think... no, I didn't get that vibe at all.
So are you saying that I'll never get to look forward to having the return of David Marcus?
I don't think so. Oh. Not in this franchise.
Dang. Okay.
I wanted to also give Simon Pegg a lot of credit, especially in the wake of Into Darkness, for handling fan service really well. You know, we talked about the Zindi references and the Enterprise stuff, but like, you know, he makes a reference to Who Mourns for Adne with the giant green hand. It never felt like he was like pounding you over the head, because, you know, yes, this movie has the destruction of the Enterprise like Star Trek III.
Sure.
And it's,
where it also like falls into the atmosphere of a planet.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But it never feels as heavy-handed or awkward. Like, there was not once I wanted to cringe.
Yeah, you know, I think the genius is like fans will just like nod their head and smile, and then non-fans, they won't even know. The trick is you don't want to make non-fans feel as if they're missing out on some inside joke.
Right.
You know, if some guy references the Zindi War and the Romulan War, non-fans are going to be like, oh yeah, those are just aliens, whereas fans are be like, oh yeah.
Well, and he says, you know, I fought the Romulans and the Zindi. They probably remember Romulan maybe from the 2009, maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
So they'll go, okay, I don't know what the Zindi is, whatever.
Sure, yeah.
Then gloss over it. There's one word there that they might pick up on and one that they won't, who cares?
I mean, okay, let me come back to this. How do you think it's surprising that, like, Simon Pegg and Doug Jung seem to be such fans of Enterprise? Because that is like the stepchild of Star Trek right now, is it not?
I mean, maybe they aren't, but maybe when they are, you know, writing the film, they're doing research into the, you know, the archives of Star Trek and looking for ways to connect the two.
Yeah, didn't Simon Pegg do interviews saying that he was on Memory Alpha quite a lot.
Yeah, so that could have been it right there.
Well, that disappoints me if that's all it was, because...
I don't know if he was watching all of Season 3 Enterprise.
For new listeners, Tyler, since I started doing this podcast, I've had a Road to Damascus moment when it comes to Enterprise, where I really did not like those first two seasons.
You were like Kirk at the start of this movie.
Mopey.
And by the end, you knew your place, which was as a Enterprise fan.
But thanks to doing this podcast and having to do additional research, Cam and our fallen co-host, Benjamin Yong, they convinced me to pick Enterprise up in season 3, season 4 of Enterprise. I truly think like those are like phenomenal seasons. I think season 4 is one of the strongest seasons of Star Trek period, you know, and it's Enterprise, which I know a lot of you fans hate. I know a lot of you new fans are listening to Tyler saying, like, he likes Enterprise, he doesn't like Star Trek Beyond. Yeah. Get him off the podcast here.
Right. Well, I'm working on it. But another thing I want to actually reference, too, that really worked for me was Michael Giacchino's score. I was not a fan of his work in Into Darkness. He kind of recycled a lot of the themes that I really loved in the 2009 movie and brought almost nothing new to the table.
Well, what about the when Khan and Kirk were going from the Enterprise to the Vengeance? I thought, do you recall the score at all?
It was very unmemorable to me.
Okay, I remember that moment. That was one of the few moments that did stick out to me as a good score. But with this, I know. What about the kind of the allusions that we had throughout to the original series? Like,
yes, there is the scene where Kirk is fighting Krall in the Enterprise. And the music suddenly turns into, like, it's almost like the arena, the, you know, the Gorn battle.
I even, at a moment, and maybe it was just in my own mind, but, like, it seemed as if there's, like, some Amok Time allusions as well.
That's also, crossed
and
my mind.
I was just like, oh, yeah. That, to me, that's my favorite Star Trek musical cue of all time is Amok. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that and the Doomsday Machine music.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool.
So, like, I love that he seemed to be kind of getting the spirit, like the rest of the cast, of really getting to the spirit of the 60s show. Because it felt like with the JJ ones that they were almost a little bit ashamed of it. They wanted the characters, you know, they wanted the iconography of it. But they didn't quite want to commit to that type of storytelling the way that this one, at least I felt, did in the early sections.
Well, I do recall Michael Giacchino doing interviews saying that they waited until the very end of the 2009 film to introduce, you know, the original series score, because he's like, we need to feel as if we earned it.
And they've done that in every movie.
Yeah. I was looking forward to more Rihanna. I can't believe I had to sit through the credits until I got my Rihanna fix.
I just don't understand, like, why are they so shy about playing the Star Trek theme?
I don't know, because it's a beautiful theme.
I know.
And it's very iconic. Cam, you've got me.
It's strange to me. Why don't we move into what doesn't work, and maybe I'll defend some things, maybe you'll defend some things, but it'll be
I won't defend anything.
we'll kind of debate some points, I think. Tyler, why don't you start? What didn't work for you?
I love Stringer Bell. Mm-hmm. I think Idris Elba is a spectacular actor. I'm following all this Dark Tower news that's going up because I think it's genius casting to get him to play Roland Deschain in this new franchise. I love Idris Elba.
Right.
Krall, what's going on here, Cam? I've been thinking about this for the last 24 hours, or I guess 22 hours. Yeah. I cannot figure out this character at all.
There was a point, you know, when he departs his planet.
Earth, apparently?
Well, he departs the planet.
Is the name of the planet, by the way?
I don't know.
Exactly.
I didn't catch it.
I don't know either.
But he's departing to go to the Yorktown. And I was thinking to myself, in the theater at that very moment, this is one of the worst Star Trek villains I've ever seen.
Yes.
I think they redeem him a bit by the end. I actually think he... I figured out he was human, actually, fairly early. As soon as he had his first sort of infusion and looked less reptilian, I was like, oh, okay, he's human.
To me, I was just wondering what the hell was going on with that. The only thing that kind of maybe spoiled it or maybe tipped me off, and again, I'm not going to say that I realized he was the captain of the Franklin.
Yeah.
But there's all these tweets going about, like, saying, do not watch this new TV spot for Star Trek Beyond. It'll spoil it. So I was like, okay, well, but all the images were with Krall. So I was like, okay, well, there's a big Krall related spoiler going on. Mm-hmm. So that just made my mind, you know, moving. I only ended up watching that particular TV spot today.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, did you see that TV spot?
No, I haven't watched it.
What they do is they show the footage of Balthazar Edison, like, okay, on video.
Right.
Do you remember
right.
when he's giving his testimonial?
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay, well, there you go. It's Idris Elba the human.
That is bizarre.
That if I don't understand why they did
Who
that.
Who wants to see the movie based on seeing that?
Look, I think Idris Elba is a very well-respected actor. He's not, like, a celebrity or anything.
No, I mean, how many trailers for Pacific Rim had him yelling, cancel the apocalypse? And that movie was not a box office phenomenon.
No.
So I don't know.
Well, not in North America.
Not in North America.
Cam, you didn't like that movie. I didn't like that movie. Whenever I encounter somebody here who says, oh, it's amazing, I just shrug. There's a lot of sand underwater. Yeah. That's all I remember.
Yeah, it was. I thought it was awful.
So, okay, with Crawl, the whole time I'm watching this movie, is like, I don't understand this dude's motivation.
Yeah.
And then we get to it, they have the big reveal that he is Captain Balthazar Edison, a former Mako. For whatever reason, they give a soldier a ship to captain.
Yeah,
that makes zero sense to me.
It was like they got rid of the military and then made him a captain instead.
Why?
Why not?
He had zero qualifications to be a captain.
They made neither did Kirk.
Okay. You got me there. Okay, it's the Kelvin timeline.
And they were going to offer him a vice admiral job too, so.
Yeah, okay.
Why not?
So I'm like, okay, well, so they give this unqualified guy
yeah.
a captaincy.
I'm willing and, to accept it because maybe it's at the point where they don't have captains. They're like, well, he was a military leader. Let's make him a captain. I don't know. I'm willing to go along with the ride.
Okay, but the thing is, the whole point, they got rid of the military because yes. Starfleet wasn't supposed to be military.
Right.
It's supposed to be like this scientific exploratory organization.
Right.
Why would you put a soldier, a career soldier, in charge of exploring the universe? He would be, you know, so quick to fire on a ship, yeah. whereas an archer would just, you know, relent and get his ass kicked, you know, by the alien of the week, as we saw in every other episode, I'd say.
Are you saying you wouldn't want to see that show, though, with Balthazar?
Balthazar Edison? I would absolutely 100% watch Idris Elba captaining the Franklin, because right. I love the Franklin. Like, I think the bridge design of the Franklin, like, it was this tactile kind of look. It seemed like the next step up from the Enterprise. I think the bridge design just, like, totally got me. It looked kind of yeah. cool. It almost had this Millennium Falcon sort of feel to it. Maybe even sort of like Serenity kind of thing. It totally worked for me in there. Balthazar Edison did not. Crawl did not. Can I get into it, Cam?
Yeah, go nuts.
Okay, so I get it. They crash land on this planet. He says there are aliens on this planet that can absorb like life force.
Right.
He becomes one of them.
No, he basically injects himself with DNA to be basically immortal.
Okay.
And that's what transforms him into a reptilian creature.
Okay, and so he just keeps sucking up other people's life force.
Yeah.
And he learns how to speak English?
Well, I would assume he always knew how to speak English.
But he can't conjugate verbs in this film? Crawl, like, he forgets how to speak English after 100 years?
The thing is that I was completely willing to go along with that because I believe, like, that if someone who is essentially altering their DNA may become more animal-like and maybe lose that ability. Like, if I start splicing you with a chimp right now, you may not be speaking quite as eloquently.
No, if it's me, I'd probably speak more eloquently. Let's be honest.
But you know what I mean? Like, if you became half animal, maybe that wouldn't be the case. So, like, I was willing to go along with that, that he is. Maybe, like, the structure of alien vocal cords is completely different. He can't pronounce English words. Like, I was totally fine with that. I could okay. cross that bridge.
Well, let's get into his motivation.
Yeah, that's to me the problem.
He's a soldier.
Yes.
So he fights wars. Now that there's peace, he wants to create wars again because that's... I'm trying to, like, get behind it.
Yeah.
And that is his motivation. He's a career soldier. He wants struggle. You know, he doesn't think the Federation really works as a concept.
Right.
To me, I'm just kind of like... Really, you're going to devote 100 years of your immortal life to... Why? Like, why does he care so much? Because the Federation yeah. didn't come and rescue him?
That was part of it, but it
did. How do they know, though? I mean, like, he can be a thinking man and realize, oh, well, it's probably pretty hard for them to, like, find me.
But did the Nebula look that hard to get through?
No, it was very easy. It was very much like how they went through to the center of the galaxy in Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, the movie I think is closest to capturing the spirit of the original series.
Right.
That was just, that was pretty easy to get through.
Yeah.
This Nebula was as easy as hell to get through. They even skipped past it when they went back to the Yorktown.
Yeah.
Don't you think Krall could have easily found his way back to the Federation, or I should say Edison could have easily found his way back to the Federation space and be like, hey guys, I know you couldn't rescue me, but I'm back here.
Yeah.
Want to give me another, you know, command? I don't know. To me, like, you know, his motivation made no sense to me. I thought he was so boring. I thought he was just this thug. And, okay, you say another thing, because I know you have something on your tip of your tongue.
Yeah, I do.
Because I have an even bigger thing that I think is far more concerning about this
film. Do you know what his motivation reminded me a lot of? Was Zod in Man of Steel.
Okay.
Now, Zod has the excuse in that he has been genetically bred to be a warrior.
Sure, and I kind of...
Krall does not have that.
No. I kind of... Doug Zod, in Man of Steel, he works for me, I think, almost exclusively because of Michael Shannon.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, I like Krall, I think, more than I like Zod. But to me, what redeemed Krall for
me... Well, no. Tell me first what redeems Zod.
Not much.
Okay.
What redeemed Krall for me was the fact that, like, I actually like the idea of how they're paralleling him with Kirk. And that neither of them really know their place. Like, he's like, I'm a warrior, but I don't understand this world. Kirk's like, I'm an explorer, but I don't know if I belong as an explorer. Like, I can see that they were trying to line up those two arcs.
Okay.
Now, I don't think it pays off. And I, you know, was talking with Fallen co-host Ben Yong as we were walking home, saying, like, the Krall stuff to me, like, the reveal of him as, you know, human and as a former Starfleet and all that sort of stuff. I wonder if it would have worked if it had been revealed earlier, just to flesh it out more. It feels like... It happens in, like, the last, 15 minutes when there's big action scenes and all that. So you don't get to kind of take it in and have...
How many times do we have to watch Uhura play the reverse button? I was like, okay, I get it. It's Idris Elba. I get it.
But it was a really crappy video where even I couldn't even tell what they were looking at half the time.
Well, to me, as soon as they walked into the Franklin, they had that video come up again. I was like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
I didn't realize he was going to be the captain, but I was like, okay, well, he... Like, this is the whole Franklin crew. They all became aliens.
Yeah, I didn't pick up that it was a Franklin. I just knew I could figure out that he was human.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yes, what was more concerning to you?
I like Simon Pegg.
Yeah.
I really do, as a writer. And maybe I'm just going to go back to A World's End, which it's a movie I really like.
Yeah.
It's a comedy. It's a dark comedy. You're touching a lot of dark themes. Spoiler alert. Skip the next 15 seconds. If you have not seen The World's End, you should go and see it. Cam, end of World's End, everybody's pretty much dead, right?
Right.
You know, he's very capricious there.
Mm-hmm.
End of spoilers. Back to spoilers for Star Trek Beyond. I was very put off by the capriciousness of, like, just how many deaths among the Enterprise crew were featured throughout this film when they had such an emphasis in Star Trek Into Darkness. Say what you will of that film, but there's so much emphasis placed on the fact that Kirk had not yet lost any crew members, and that had given him, you know, kind of this moxie that one Admiral Pike said was unearned. Like, it's not because you're a great commander, it's because you got lucky, dude. And the fact that, like, they just lost so many crew members, and just the way that they were dying with, like, Krall sucking out their life force, that seemed, like, brutal. And that wonderful, like, if an alien could ever just be called cute... That cute alien with the expanding skull, like, she dies in the most horrible way possible.
Yeah, by a vaguely defined super weapon.
I don't know what the super weapon is.
That was a really... I thought that was awful. Like, the weapon he uses is so poorly defined, and we were joking on the way home that it's the weapon, super weapon that kills people one at a time.
No kidding. Why not just get a nuke?
Do more damage.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. So, what did you think about, like, did you notice it at the time, just like, oh, they're willing to just kill people off one by one, and or just in big order? How many, like, crew members of the Enterprise do you think died throughout this film?
A lot.
I would say at least half.
Yeah, I never felt like Kirk was tormented by that. Like, I felt like he needed a moment, you know, maybe when he stumbles across those red shirts that have all been, like, drained or something.
Yeah.
There's a moment where he just is, like, hurt by that.
The reason it bugs me so much, I could otherwise just shrug my shoulders, but it was made to be such a big deal in the previous film.
Yeah.
Here, he doesn't really seem to care. And correct me if I'm wrong, did Cupcake die in Star Trek Into Darkness?
I don't think so.
So where was Cupcake in this?
Whatever.
I don't know, but I like the continuity, because we don't have any Cupcake in this. And remember last year we saw the guy who played like science officer number, whatever his name was?
The bald guy, yeah.
Yeah, right. He has like alopecia.
Right.
He wasn't in this film either. I would have liked to see like more, you know, crew members that we've seen in the past. We got some new ones like Skull Girl, who died horribly.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know, the capriciousness really put me off in this film.
I didn't find it as offensive.
Well, you're a capricious man.
I am. I think it's because all the JJ movies had a lot of death and no one noticed. You would have crew members getting sucked into space and they were never acknowledged again.
Okay. In the 2009 film.
Yes.
Not in the Into Darkness film, because that was made to be such a...
Yeah, that was the arc of Kirk in that movie.
Yeah.
I feel like he cares depending on what his arc is in the movie.
I know.
This wasn't about that. This was Kirk getting his groove back.
So the two things that I mentioned here, you know, Crawl.
Yeah.
The capriciousness, those are the two big things for me. I can get into the smaller things. You recall earlier in this episode, I was making a face.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about the climax of the film.
Yeah.
Where for the third film in a row, the climax is on a platform of some sort.
But not on a garbage truck.
Not on a garbage truck. Not on a Romulan ship's platform.
Yeah.
But on some other platform, including gravity streams. And I was just like, I've seen this climax twice before, but you liked it. Justify yourself, Cam.
I liked that they kind of mixed it up a bit with like the gravity distortion things or whatever. I thought that made it more fun, a little Inception-y.
We saw that in Into Darkness when when Khan and Kirk rocketed between the Enterprise and the Vengeance, and I think that was a sequence done far better.
Maybe, but I could not have cared less about Khan. I thought Khan was the worst villain in the series. Him and Marcus. I was more invested in Krall at this point. Once like the reveal came and I learned more about him, I actually cared about what was going on with him and Kirk together.
Okay.
And I think on a technical level, it was well directed. Was it something we've seen before? Yeah, we saw it in Insurrection, for God's sakes.
Yeah. How many of these... And look, we're talking about platforms. We saw it in Generations.
Yeah.
Recall in Star Trek First Contact, Picard swinging from a rope and kicking the Borg Queen in the face.
Does Nemesis count?
I think Nemesis counts as well. Yeah. What's the deal with platforms?
Well, all of these movies are about villains that want revenge, and that's become maybe a problem we should get to, save it for the end.
Okay.
Like, kind of like a wrap-up about the movies.
Sure, yeah.
But, I mean, like, where do you rank Krall compared to the other JJs? Because I don't think he's had a home run series of villains. I think Nero is still my favorite.
I think Nero's my favorite, and that's not saying much.
No, but I kind of like the redneck Romulan.
Yeah. Where does Krall rank? I think he ranks at the bottom for me.
Really? Okay. Yeah, I mean...
I could understand why somebody would rank him above Khan. Here's the thing. You and I, we've discussed this. We've agreed on it. If you did not call John Harrison Khan, you just called him John Harrison, I think he would have been a good antagonist. And I think all because of Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah.
You know, even though I think his motivation, once again, is very questionable. At least I understood Nero's motivation.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
I love Idris Elba, and I didn't get into Krall at all.
I got enough to enjoy him. I don't think he is in any way, shape, or form one of the great villains of the summer or anything. And you know who this movie reminded me often of? Civil War. And I really began to compare it, you know, like, they're both going for similar things, where it's kind of poppy characters bouncing off each other, colorful, larger than life, with kind of an ambiguous villain, where you don't quite know what their motivations are for most of the movie.
Yeah.
Baron Zemo in Civil War is, I think, far more compelling than Krall is, because I think when you get the reveal of what Baron Zemo is all about in Civil War, it means something. Like, it's emotional.
I absolutely 100% agree. And it's weird because he seems like such a far more low-key villain than... Not low-key. But like a low hyphen key villain compared with what you get from the other Marvel films. But for whatever reason, like, Baron Zemo works for me. And I think it all comes down to that motivation. You get it. It's based on like the kind of mythology going that they've built up so far in that Marvel cinematic universe.
Yeah. And I really think that's why Marvel is so damn good at these blockbusters. Like, Civil War is to me still the best movie of the summer.
Do you think they just have Kevin Feige to thank for everything?
I think so. I mean, you have Kevin Feige overseeing the stories of all these movies and everything. I just think he has more of an interest in storytelling than probably Paramount does with these to a certain degree.
And that's kind of why I'm look, I like these films like that we've gotten since 2009, you know.
But I like two of them.
But there's stuff in Into Darkness that I can take away that I like. There's stuff from Beyond that I take away and enjoy. Believe me, guys, I need to see Beyond again for me to fully wrap my head around it. Like, it's not a movie that I disliked, but it's not a movie that I came out jubilant with. But I really feel as if they need, like, a solid shepherd for this franchise, and they don't have that, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, Justin Lin is not coming back, what it sounds like. And so, who's overseeing these movies?
Well, Dune is, based on the interviews, it's J.J. Abrams again.
Yeah.
Because he's been talking all about how Chris Hemsworth is coming back. Maybe we can touch upon that a little bit. We touched upon it in the previous episode. But,
yeah.
So at this point, my only hope, and I think it's a fool's hope,
yeah,
is that, look, we've got Simon Pegg entrenched in the franchise.
He's not writing the next one, though.
He's not?
No.
That's been confirmed?
They named two other writers, and Simon Pegg was not one of them.
Oh, who's writing the next one, then?
Well, it's J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay.
Who are they?
I don't know. They have some unproduced screenplays, like Flash Gordon.
Okay.
That's about it. And apparently, they maybe wrote an early draft of Beyond, but they weren't credited on the final film, so I would imagine most of it was scrapped. Maybe they kept a couple things.
Okay, well, where I was going with this is I was hoping that Simon Pegg would be back and he'd be able to rope in one Edgar Wright. I don't think that's going to happen now.
Well, let's hope this one's such a train wreck that they have to bring him in again to rewrite it.
Okay, well... So, again, Cam, we've been having this discussion ever since we started the podcast.
Yeah.
The film franchise, it doesn't really have, like, a real leader, and I think that's to Paramount's detriment at this point, you know? I don't know what to say. My only hope, though, is that, look, Star Trek 2017 is, like, a critical hit.
Yeah.
CBS, they can recognize... Because here's the thing. For CBS, it's going to be, like, they're taking, like, the long view when it comes to generating revenue.
Yeah.
So I think they can recognize, hey, if it's at least a critical hit, if we're getting enough traction when it comes to streaming views,
yeah,
you know, maybe Brian Fuller is onto it. Maybe they'll get Brian Fuller to step in for film number 5. I don't know.
So much depends on what happens with these movies.
I know.
Now, this one was kind of predicted to not open so spectacularly.
But
it looks like it's actually going to outperform Into Darkness or come close to matching it.
Yeah.
So, which means to me that, the fourth one will happen.
But the
question is, how many do we get Beyond 4? Is 4 maybe
Beyond
the end?
Beyond 4?
Yeah. But is 4 maybe the end? Is it, like, how many times do we get... I know we've argued back and forth.
I know.
But, like,
you had me yell at you already.
But, like, most film franchises don't go that long. So...
No, that's true.
The question is, how long does J.J. Abrams remain interested in producing these things? How long...
He's making a boatload of money.
I know.
And, like, how involved... How many hours of the week... does he have to spend on it versus how much money he gets in his bank account?
Right, I mean, no matter how big the return is for Paramount, J.J. Abrams is making out just fine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so much depends on that. I mean, say they do the next one, and say 4 is the wrap-up movie. Like, say all along, that's what it's designed to do and wrap it up. Say J.J. Abrams is like, I want to go out on top. And then that's it. Maybe the next iteration has someone with a strong vision coming in to do them. Who knows? The TNG reboot or whatever it is. So much depends on what the future holds for this franchise. If they're just going to keep cranking them out, I don't see anything changing, because why bother?
That makes me sad, though.
I know.
Here's the thing. Like, we talked about it before.
Yeah.
If Nicholas Meyer had just stuck around as a shepherd for the series from Wrath of Khan on,
yeah,
think about how more consistent that would have been. You know.
For sure. I mean... Well, we did have Harv Bennett.
Yeah, and it's disappointing to me that, like, he kind of got the boot after Star Trek V, but the good news is, like, Nick Meyer came back in. Star Trek VI, that's the way you end a franchise.
Yeah.
You know?
But I think we can both agree that Star Trek is best in TV. Like, the movies have never really lived up to the TV show.
We won't disagree on that. Look, let's face it. I think based on our previous podcast, we can both agree that there's maybe, like, 3 or 4 tops films that are great.
Yeah.
You know, I think you and I differ on maybe what the fourth one is.
Yeah.
You're going more into the motion picture territory. I'm leaning more towards First Contact.
Right.
I think we both agree on Star Trek II, Star Trek VI, as well as 2009.
Right.
So, you know, Cam, if anything, can we agree that we're both very excited for Star Trek 2017?
We are.
Yeah. There you go.
But so let's move on to some other things that don't work, because I think we can both agree the crawl thing.
Yeah.
Maybe a decent idea on paper. Like, there may have been some cut stuff. I think there probably was.
Okay, but even if there's cut stuff...
But that's irrelevant to the final product.
Yeah, but I don't know if the execution... And this is what kills me. I love Idris Elba, and I just don't know if the execution of this was very well done.
Yeah.
And I'm not blaming it on him. It's just it's what he's been given.
And here's the thing. We're more invested in that character, because when he talked about the Zindi Wars and all this, we're like, oh my god, he was a Mako from Enterprise, all this. To the average person, do you think they feel at all invested in him?
No, but I think to the average person, he's just like another dumb thug villain.
Sure.
Like, he's not intriguing. And that's why I kind of think that at least John Harrison, I don't want to acknowledge him as Khan.
Yeah.
At least John Harrison has some sort of nuance to him. I don't see, there's no nuance to Krall at all.
Right. Okay, well, let's move on to some other things that didn't work. For me, like, I talked before about some of the action sequences that I thought were phenomenally well done in the movie. Really effective. There was a few that didn't, though. I thought the nighttime Enterprise sequence, the crashed Enterprise sequence, was pretty bad.
I didn't dig it myself.
No, like, we've already seen them running through the Enterprise as it's collapsing.
Yeah.
Then to see them do it again in the dark.
Yeah.
And then slide down in the dark.
And slide down in the dark and survive?
Yeah.
I was like, okay, guys.
And even the reason for going there was questionable. It's like they had this whole action set piece built on them not accomplishing their goal.
Yeah, they wanted to out the alien captain. What did you think of that alien captain, though?
The alien captain?
The woman who tricked them.
I like that, actually.
I actually did, yeah. I don't recall her name.
And I thought it was interesting, because the whole time I was watching her that character with Chekhov and Kirk, I was going like, boy, they really cut around her in those trailers.
Yeah, I was surprised, too. I honestly thought that she was going to be revealed as somebody part of Krall species or...
Yeah.
But I understand... Okay, here's the thing. I understand her motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk comes to understand her motivation as well. Like, she says explicitly, I was trying to save my crew. He's like, okay, I guess I won't shoot you.
Right.
I'll let you get crushed by my saucer.
Well, that was... He didn't mean to do that.
I don't think he minded after she kind of betrayed him.
The other action sequence, there's another one that I... There's one that didn't work for me, and then there's one that really didn't work for me.
Oh, okay.
So let's get to the other one that didn't work for me with a small didn't, was the final, like, just chase through the Yorktown in the ships.
Okay.
I just found it kind of bland. It didn't really
contribute
much. I didn't think it was particularly well edited.
Yeah, I mean, okay. I guess I have to defend it. The one thing that I did like, and I guess it's a little bit derivative of what we saw in Into Darkness.
Yes.
But when the Franklin popped out of the water.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, if I had never seen that before in Into Darkness, I think that would have been a great moment there.
It would have been better, because you have like the people running around this sort of looks like a city, and then they landing in the water. I was like, wow, one movie.
How did it pop out of the water exactly?
I don't know.
I don't
profess to
know.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the action sequence that really did not work for me is the big Sabotage Beastie Boys extravaganza.
Yeah, I agree. Because they had built it up, and I was like, okay, I guess we're going to listen to Fight the Power. But then they had Sabotage in the trailer, so... Yeah, I don't know. Cam, I know you've produced a rap album.
Yeah.
I'm not joking. Cam has produced a rap album.
Right. Not a good one, but yes.
It's rap music's never been my thing.
Yeah.
I've always been like kind of a rock guy or, you know,
Sure.
Or
Beastie Boys kind of fall into rap rock.
Yeah. Especially Sabotage. Yeah. That's the kind of the first kind of like rap rock, you know, it's pre-Nookie, right?
Right.
Yeah. Can we leave the Beastie Boys behind? They've been in all three movies at this point.
Yeah, I mean, this whole sequence made me cringe.
Yes.
It didn't cringe initially, but then it kept going and going, and I was like, oh man, this is like Poochie. You know, like, this is like, hey, Mr. S. And, you know, the thing is, they established that they have to play this music, or make a sound, you know, a discordant sound, essentially, to disrupt the connection between all these different ships.
The psychic connection.
Yeah, the hive. And so, like, my question to you is, were the ships just, like, bouncing off each other because they couldn't organize each other? Were they exploding?
I didn't understand anything that was going on. I think they were exploding. I don't think they were bouncing off each other. Why would music make them blow up?
I don't know. Like, if had it showed, like, the connection break between them all, and they're just, like, bouncing off each other, you know, and it's, like, kind of like a domino effect, that makes sense to me. But it just looked like they were blowing up from the might of the Beastie Boys.
Cam, did you ever watch that Marilyn Manson interview that Bill O'Reilly did on Fox News?
Yeah.
I have to imagine this is what all those Fox News viewers imagine rap music is like. This is what it'll do to society. Yeah. It'll make you blow up.
Yeah.
You know, turn you into a fiery inferno here.
This was one of those bad blockbuster moments that just make me cringe. Kind of like the, you know, the gymnast girl kicking the raptor in Lost World.
Oh, I wouldn't put it on.
It's not that bad.
That was one of the worst movie moments of all time.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know,
this to me just felt so generic. But I say that, but it was kind of cool watching the Franklin, like, whiz away.
Yeah, yeah. I liked seeing it go through all the fire and everything. It looked great, but just...
To what effect, though?
It just felt like so cartoony and stupid.
Yeah, I agree.
In a movie that didn't pander that much, that felt really pandering to me.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, normies, here's some Beastie Boys, you know what I mean? And it's like not like anyone went crazy about the use of that song in the original movie.
No.
So I just thought it was really lame.
Okay. I do like the fact that McCoy was like, is this classical music?
Yeah.
Spock's like, yes, this is classical.
They tried to redeem it as best they could.
I do like the fact that, because you and I think we've brought up on the show before that, like, it's as if young James Kirk was rocking out to what our equivalent of Brock music would be. Like, why would, like, this 12-year-old kid going on a joyride listen to music from 400 years ago?
Right.
Okay, can I jump on something that just didn't work for me?
Yeah.
This is, and I think, my last big thing that didn't work
for me. I got a controversial one to end with.
Okay.
So, yeah.
That's good. The scope of the film. Really, we only explored a grand total of two locations. The Yorktown and that planet that was named very briefly. I think it was called, like, Ariel, or, I don't know, is that, like... A reference to maybe the Tempest?
There's also the one at the opening that you missed.
Okay, so a total of three locations.
But that's more of a room.
And that's we were there for 3 minutes total?
Two and a half minutes.
Okay. Just the scope of the film, it felt so much smaller than the previous two films that took place in the Kelvin timeline.
Which also kind of earns the Insurrection comparison, I think.
Yeah. At least we had the... Okay. Didn't the Briar's Patch feel a lot scarier to you than this nebula that they had to pass through?
Yeah, it did, actually.
Yeah, which is kind of surprising.
That's the most favorable thing I'll say towards Insurrection over this movie. That's about it. I think this is far and away infinitely better than Insurrection. But yes, the Briar Patch was kind of cool.
Yeah. So, the scope seems so small. And I was kind of down for a film where it was the crew stranded on a planet. To me, it seemed cool. Maybe, I don't know, it's just you and I, we live in Vancouver. This film was primarily filmed in Vancouver, so when we see all these forest scenes, we're like, yeah, we see that all the time. It doesn't seem exotic to you or I. Did it feel as if you were on an alien planet, or did it feel like you were walking around your own backyard, Cam?
It felt a lot like my backyard, with the odd, like, CG flower thrown in. Like, you compare that to that opening planet from Into Darkness.
Which was created, they were originally planning on doing this all in Hawaii, and then they realized that they couldn't really recreate what they were looking for, so they just built it all on set. Mm-hmm. That looks like an alien planet. Like that.
I mean, I don't know if that would be functional for the amount of locations they need within the planet. In this movie, I don't know.
But you notice, like, a lot of this took place in, like, a quarry?
Yeah.
I was like, really?
Yeah.
Like, to me, quarry equals cheap sci-fi.
Yeah, it's true. Although, it wasn't cheap. We know that.
No.
Yeah, there was no... Like, this was not a planet that was memorable. You know, and, like,
we don't even know its name.
A lot of the original series planets, despite the fact they were done on a shoestring budget and had, like, just, like, a different, colored sky... were really memorable.
Yeah. I'll even throw this out there. I think the Insurrection planet was more memorable than this. The architecture in there, absolutely.
I don't know. I think they're pretty comparable.
I give the edge to Insurrection. I'm not, believe me, I'm not going to fight for the Insurrection planet.
So far, let me just get this straight. You're fighting for Insurrection in the Final Frontier in this episode. Is that what we're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
New listeners, Tyler loves Insurrection and Final Frontier.
Yeah. I mean, I can agree that this, like, planet was not... You know, Star Trek's all about exploring strange new worlds. There was nothing strange or new about this world.
The reason it really kind of guts me is because it was filmed in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Okay, British Columbia, there's so much diversity in the locations here, yeah. And they go for generic forest. I'm just like, okay, like, really, like, Kim, you can go to, like, southeastern BC, it's like this cool desert plain, I guess very similar to what you've seen in, like, previous Star Trek films. Go to northern BC, there's these amazing glaciers and mountains, go to the island, there's rainforests. This, we just see typical Vancouver forest that they're walking around. Do you think this is filmed in, like, the North Shore Mountains?
Yeah, it looked like a lot, like, by just actually right behind my house, really.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah.
So, to me, it just feels like...
What's a real bummer to me is, you know, they've said that Chris Hemsworth is going to be back in the next one.
Which, I don't think that's a bummer.
No, that's not a bummer, but just the fact that kind of hints towards maybe a time travel movie. Whereas, like, to me, if it's a time travel movie, that may really cut down the number of strange new worlds we're going to visit in that one.
Yeah.
So it's like, we could have seen maybe one of the last new lands we're going to discover in this new franchise. But
That ties into kind of the scope of this film, which... Yeah. Go back to 2009. We had that awesome ice planet.
Yeah.
We got to explore Vulcan as well. I thought that was cool. We had that. We got to go to Kronos in Into Darkness. We got to go to that volcano planet. You know, the scope just seems so much smaller.
It is very small.
And I could have been down with that, because I always dig films that are more character-based as opposed to, like, action or story-based. I don't know. I was disappointed by...
I'll give them points for the Yorktown. Because I think the Yorktown actually stood out almost as much as a planet, anyway.
My only problem is I kept looking for, like, familiar locations in Vancouver that may have stood in for their Yorktown. I think... comedian Mark Maron, I listened to his podcast... He's come up to Vancouver to perform before, and he describes Vancouver as a city that looks like it was built from a kit.
Right.
You know, which I kind of agree with. So if you want, like, a futuristic looking planet, you'd film it in Vancouver, would you not, Cam? Or at least, like, the Yale Town neighborhood, maybe kind of the Central Business District.
Sure.
Did you recognize any Vancouver landmarks?
No, but I never noticed Vancouver landmarks. I'm an idiot for stuff like that.
I am somebody who's...
Unless it's the woods by my house, then no.
Okay, serial killer. me, I'm an Einstein for this sort of stuff. I really didn't pick up on any kind of Vancouver landmarks. I thought for a second maybe the convention center, but then I was like, no, unless they totally CGI'd it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I try not to even focus on that stuff because I feel like it's so irrelevant to anyone who doesn't live here.
True. But it's not like, dude, it's not like we live in, say, Atlanta.
I know, but I always get annoyed when I listen to podcasts that, like, are New York-based and all they do is complain about New York locations. I'm like, oh boy, so full of themselves.
But, okay, I'll say this, though, Cam. You and I, we both saw that same episode of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. that took place in Vancouver.
Sort of.
That was embarrassing.
That was.
Because I just need to mention this once more. They have the crew landing in Vancouver. Apparently Vancouver is surrounded by nothing but sea. Where the defining characteristic of Vancouver is that it's surrounded by mountains and sea.
Right.
That's all. Listeners, please, if you haven't tuned out by now, go ahead.
Let's move on to my controversial
point. Okay, good. Let's do it.
Now, I love this cast. I've seen them reach greatness. One member of this cast, to me, didn't hit very well in this movie. Can you guess who it would be?
Okay. Let's go through the seven. We've got... It's not McCoy. You dug McCoy.
Yes, I did.
You dug Kirk in this. You highlighted Zoe Saldana a little bit. Greatness. Was it Chekhov?
No. Spock, to me, was actually disappointed.
I was wondering
movie.
If it was going to be that. But... I'd be willing to defend Spock, but tell me.
My issue is with Spock is I think...
He's a stalker?
Well, you know, whatever.
With his radioactive jewelry that he gives. That didn't
bother me. What it is...
Could I call him a Spocker?
Sure. The thing is about Spock is that I think, like, the best performance of Spock we've seen so far was in the 2009, the Zach Quinto performance.
Yes.
Into Darkness, he kind of gets swallowed up by that whole movie, and then has to yell Khan. In this one, I feel
and fight on a garbage truck.
Maybe it's because I've been rewatching the original series, but, like, Nimoy Spock is insanely charismatic. And Quinto in this movie felt so aloof and distant that I could just never really, like, I never felt the character of Spock. Like, this almost felt to me like Vulcan by way of Tuvok. Not quite Tuvok bad, but you know what I mean?
I'm going to defend Quinto.
Go for it.
I get where you're coming from. We do get moments where Spock literally laughs.
Sure.
You know? And there's some serious nuance to him where he finds out that his parallel dude has passed away, and he's like, oh, maybe I need to break up with my gal and, you know, get some more Vulcan babies going. You know, so there's stuff going on with him there. So there are moments with Spock. I agree. Like, I think he was at his best in 2009.
Yeah.
You know, this maybe wasn't the highlight. I think the reason you're so disappointed is because you've seen what Zach Quinto can do with the character.
Yeah, and for sure, when I watched the original series, like, I want to see Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. Like, I'm excited every time those three are on screen. This franchise, I'm more interested in watching McCoy than I am Spock.
How often were the three of them actually all
Not
together?
Not much in this movie at all.
I recall some on the Franklin. I recall a tiny bit when they're at the very end of the movie having drinks together.
But I don't even mean just seeing the three of them together. I mean, like, whichever one is on screen, they're commanding the screen in the original series.
Yeah.
Whereas in these movies, I feel like Zoe Saldana walks into a scene with Spock, she might be more interesting than Spock. Like, I just feel like Into Darkness and this one, they almost don't quite understand why Spock is probably the greatest character in the original series.
I can give you that. You know, because I honestly I think he is the most iconic. He's the most, like, magnetic.
Yeah, like, you
I didn't quite get that in this film. Yeah.
No, you cannot take your eyes off of Spock in the original series.
Well, you know, okay, let's go backwards just a little bit, because I mentioned Chekhov, though. Mm-hmm. I like Chekhov in this film.
Yeah.
How does this compare to what he got to do in the previous films?
I think he had more to do than any other ones.
And I agree with that, and I think it's, I don't want to say good timing, but I think it's like a nice testament to Anton Yelchin, who we've spoken before a few podcasts ago, who we both very much admire as an actor. But it's such a testament to him that, thank God that they gave him, like, some good stuff to do. And I think pairing him up with Chris Pine was very, very good.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that, again, like, I think one of the greatest strengths of this movie is that it gives all the characters something to do, which, frankly, you can't say about any other movie or TV episode of the original series.
Oh God, yes. Yeah. But I'm always surprised whenever I go back and watch an original series film, Chekhov always has a lot to do in every single one of those films.
Yeah.
My favorite Chekhov moment in this, you tell me yours, at the very end of the film where he's like, actually, Scotch. I don't know why I'm doing a Scottish accent.
Sure.
He's like, actually, Scotch was come from Russia.
I don't have a specific moment. I just liked watching him bounce off Kirk.
Yeah.
The two of them just exchange ideas back and forth as to what to do.
But I think the good, maybe the highlight was when they first landed on that planet and they took that alien captain by gunpoint. And they're going off each other. I also didn't mind that moment where they were frozen in that kind of stasis by Jayla's trap. Yeah,
sure.
That was kind of
That was cool.
Funny.
Yeah. What did you think of Jayla's, like, big villain of the movie?
Her big villain? What do you mean?
Like, it was like Krall's second in command was like her arch nemesis.
Okay, but one of the things that you and I have noticed is that the second banana villains have actually been far more interesting than the primary antagonist.
Not here.
Not in this at all.
He was totally disposable.
The only sort of nuance that he got is when he said to Krall, hey, no, you go ahead. You've been waiting a long time.
Yeah.
And I was just like, okay. Cam, you and I lived in Vancouver for those 6 months or so that they're filming Star Trek Beyond here.
Yeah.
We never once encountered Idris Elba.
We never encountered anyone.
Yeah, because here's the thing. We actually do encounter people in Vancouver fairly frequently. You don't know her, but the one that I encountered most recently, you and I left a theater. We saw Kristen Schaal She's a great comedic actress in Flight of the Conchords, Last Man on Earth. If you heard her voice, you'd recognize her. Cam, there's that one night, I think this is the most memorable one, is you tailed Giancarlo Esposito around the city.
I did, yeah.
And he actually greeted you with his fedora.
Yes, he did. That's very true. Yeah. So, but no, yeah, I mean, maybe they were camping in the rock quarry the whole time.
I guess so.
Although my one of my coworkers did run into Chris Pine in a grocery store, or he saw him there.
Sure. So, okay.
I mean, Yale Town.
It's easy to spot, actors here in Vancouver. Because I think the other thing about Vancouver, I guess we're going to become one of those podcasts that, you know, crow on and on about our hometown.
Well, you are.
Yes, me. But like, people don't really harass actors so much in the city.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I think people are way too polite here. Like, you don't know how much I wanted to go up to Kristen Schaal a couple weeks ago and be like, hey, I love your stuff. But I was like, oh no, she's with her boyfriend, and like, I'll just leave her alone. You know? So I don't think actors mind, you know, doing a shoot in Vancouver so much.
Right. So, okay. So as we wrap up Beyond here...
No, I want to talk more about Kristen Schaal.
Let's give our final thoughts on the movie and then just talk about where we place it in the canon of Star Trek films.
So Cam, I'm looking over my list right now.
Yes.
And as much as I've kind of crapped on this film...
Yes.
Because honestly, I had such mixed feelings when I watched it last night. I think you summed it up best earlier in the episode where you said that Star Trek works best on small screen.
Right.
So I have this ranked far higher than I ever thought I would, in fact. So I do wonder what subsequent viewings of this film will do for me. And I think it'll be good. So overall, maybe we can briefly go through our previous rankings.
Sure.
And then mention where this is going to fit in on the new spectrum.
Go for it.
So for any listeners that has yet to memorize my ranking, number one, First Contact. Number two, The Wrath of Khan. Number three, J.J. Abrams' 2009 film. Number four, The Undiscovered Country. Number five, The Search for Spock. Number six, Final Frontier. Number seven, Into Darkness. Number eight, Nemesis. Number nine, The Voyage Home. Number 10, Insurrection. Number 11, The Motion Picture. Number 12, Generations. I know that's confusing, but what I'll do now is I'm going to wedge Beyond at number five. It's now displaced The Search for Spock. I would rank this above The Search for Spock at this point.
Wow.
So it ranks at my number five, which surprises me quite a bit because I just felt so iffy about this film coming out of it. So I wonder if maybe subsequent viewings will, you know, make me turn the corner and I'll, I don't know. Could this be another... I can't imagine this will surpass Star Trek, The Undiscovered Country for me.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because when I walked out of Into Darkness, I did not in any way feel compelled to watch it again.
Okay.
Like, there was no excitement to go back and see it again in theater.
Really? Okay.
Whereas, like, with the 2009, I was, like, really excited to buy it and watch it over and over again. I've watched the Into Darkness three times, once because we had to do it for the podcast. Like, that's it. I've watched the 2009 one quite a few times.
Okay.
This one I'm already want to see in theaters again. And, you know, I look forward to owning it and whatever. So my order was, for number one, I had Wrath of Khan. Number two, I had the J.J. Abrams 2009. Number three, I had The Motion Picture.
Wow.
Number four, Undiscovered Country. Number five, Voyage Home. Number six, Search for Spock. Number seven, Into Darkness. Number eight, First Contact. Number nine, The Final Frontier. Number 10, Nemesis. Number 11, Insurrection. And number 12, Generations. So I am going to slot Star Trek Beyond into the number five slot, right below Star Trek VI and right above Star Trek IV.
So Cam, even though you were really high on this movie and I was kind of down on it, we placed this in the exact same spot of all the rankings of Star Trek films.
Well, the things you discover.
So I don't even need to see this again because I can't imagine this ever displacing The Undiscovered Country on my list. Can you imagine this bumping Undiscovered Country?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, so...
But you know what? It belongs in the upper half.
Okay, so, I agree.
And I think, you know, that's... maybe people would like us to be like going over the moon like, it's the best one or it's the second best one after Wrath of Khan. You know what, guys? This is a damn good Star Trek movie, all considered.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of them are not very good. I think I think
a lot of... the vast majority of them are not very good.
I think often we fall into the trap of saying, it's a good Star Trek movie.
Yeah.
As opposed to it's a good movie. A lot of them are not very good movies.
So at this point, can we at least say that out of 13, 5 are at least pretty good?
Yeah, for okay. sure. Oh, definitely.
Because there's a big drop-off after number 5 at this point.
I might even say 6. You know, okay. 6 are really good.
What's your number 6?
Actually, I would say 7. Because that's my Star Trek 3 Search for Spock.
7. Okay. What was your number 6?
Star Trek 4.
Okay. I think I had Star Trek 4 lower than you did.
You did. Far lower. Right below Nemesis.
I like Search for Spock. My number 6, I guess is now my number 7, would be The Final Frontier.
Oh, boy.
I don't know if I could ever elevate that into a pretty good Star Trek film. I think it captures the spirit of the original series quite well.
Yep.
I still contend that out of all the films, this one captures the original series spirit more so than anyone else.
I agree.
Star Trek 5?
Oh, no, hold on.
The Final Frontier? No, I've got that on record.
I meant Star Trek Beyond.
Okay.
Okay, well, I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com.
Yeah, next week we will be discussing showrunners throughout all of Star Trek. Cam, this will be a fun episode, I think, to dissect.
I can't wait to record it.
Yes. The interesting thing, though, is like we'll be in Las Vegas while this drops, so you guys should be thankful that even though we're on vacation, we're still giving you guys free content. The fact of the matter is, this is free. If you want to thank us, we're not asking for any Patreon accounts, like donations. Just like give us 5 stars, give us a review on iTunes. If you leave us a review, even if it's a really bad one, Cam, we read hate mail on our show.
It's true.
We'll read your bad reviews as well. So give us 5 stars, or if you really want to, you know, crush our self-esteem or suck the life force out of us, much like Krall did, you can give us 1 star, but we'll still read your review.
Okay, so you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Vidris Elba Smith.
Sorry, Cam. That's offensive. You can find me at Reportn, that's REPORTONN as in NCC-1701A. Cam, what do you think of the fact that we already have a 1701A?
I don't know. What do you think the crew of the TNG reboot will be flying?
Yeah, that's a good question. The F?
Maybe the G.
The G? Okay. Yeah. I know we're at the end of the episode, but can I just jump on this 1701A point?
Sure.
It kind of irks me because we're before the time of the original series would even take place.
Right.
We already have a 1701A.
But maybe this one just lasts them right through those the days of Star Trek 6.
It just bugs me that they built it so quickly. Were they hanging out in the Yorktown for how long?
Well, it looked nice. You could hang out there for a while.
But Starfleet wouldn't want to get like some officers back on duty in the meantime?
It's a big fleet.
I don't know. Like it just seems like building a ship like that would probably take what, like 3 years maybe?
Well, they have robots building it. They work around the clock.
I was hoping. Okay. Shout out to Generations, though. Do you not think that saucer section landing on the planet was like the only Generations shout out that will ever be on film?
Yes.
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 So I'm glad that I mentioned that before this podcast ended. So
for sure.
That was quite the tangent before we wrap the episode. Okay. But Cam, go for it.
Yes. So until next time, the arena is closed.
transfer complete.